Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to episode 18 of The Story Studio with your hosts, Luke Condor and Daniel Wilcox. Oh yeah, here we go. Check it out now.
Welcome to The Story Studio, a podcast for an independent publishing company, explores the world of self-publishing, independent art, and the future of storytelling. But you know that because you clicked on the logo and you downloaded the episode from the feed. So of course you know what you've downloaded. Hello, my name's Luke and I'm joined by...
Daniel Wilcox.
Cool. Hello, Daniel. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Luke. How are you?
You sound like you're halfway to being assimilated into the Borg, but you sound interesting, I've got to say.
Well, I think a new mic is going to be on my Christmas list as well, but my internet's being a little bit of a shit today, so.
Yeah, I don't think your mic's the problem. I think it's just the internet connection, which can't really help.
Yeah, despite turning it off and turning it on again multiple times.
I'm an IT engineer. That's 90% of my job, turning things off and on again.
Yeah.
Yeah. You'd be surprised how often it works.
Yeah. Do you not just whack stuff with spanners? That's how they do it in the shims, right?
It's a little bit more intricate than that, Dan. We use screwdrivers instead of spanners.
Ah, okay. Phillips or crossheads?
Occasionally Phillips, but a lot of the screwdrivers are specific drivers.
Wait, flathead, bollocks.
A lot of them are like specialist, like torque drivers, they're called, and they're like five heads or six heads. It depends what you're opening up. But yeah, that's super interesting for people who want to tell stories.
I think that's the ultimate opener for anyone.
We use a number of different screwdrivers in the IT support industry. We use five heads. Yeah, I'll just list for him.
Here's an extract from Luke Condor's latest book, IT and the tools we use to fix it.
Are you okay? Are you good?
Yeah, I'm good. How's your writing going? I feel like I'm going to jump in and get to you first.
Okay. I've just been doing more of the same, but I'm on about 67K. And we will go into this in more detail today, because today's episode is all about Project Dan and what it is and where we're at and all that lovely jubbly stuff. I saw some magic.
Yeah, like, go on. I was going to say, we can't do our regular here's where we're at, because it's kind of incorporated into the episode.
That is the episode, yeah, exactly.
That is the episode. It's going to be a short one, folks.
Could be a short one. I made some magic yesterday. This is a bit of an intro banter bit here.
Okay.
So
does it count as banter if you already call it banter?
Yes. Yeah. It's passable. So Kat was making some dinner. She's been like practicing the old cooking. She's been getting really good, and she was slaving away on some like chicken and she made like a chicken katsu curry thing. It's really, really good. And I was like, I need to do something here. So have you ever, you know what condensed milk is? Sorry, sweet condensed milk.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So I didn't know, you may know this, people out there may know that this is a thing, but I had no idea this would work. If you just get a big pan of boiling water, put some condensed milk into it, like just still in the tin, just drop the tin in, leave it for 3 hours, and then open it up, it's caramel that comes out of the tin. Like, it's just really lovely tasting caramel.
And what? I was, when was that a thing?
I don't know. I apparently people do it already, but I didn't even think this was like magic. Honestly, it tastes
water and condensed milk.
Well, don't put any water in the condensed milk. Just put the condensed milk tin, all the condensed and still inside the tin in the boiling water. Leave it for 3 hours. Hey presto, you've got a beautiful caramel dessert.
Okay.
It's weird. Okay. It comes out brown. It looks a bit weird, but then when you taste it, it's good. Do you remember those like Rolo yogurts? Did you have a Rolo yogurt before?
Oh, they're amazing.
You know the caramelly bit inside of it?
Don't. It's like that.
It's exactly like that.
Because my dream as a child, and, you know, just kind of as we're on the subject of telling stories, my dream as a child was to just buy as many Rolo yogurts as it took.
Yeah.
Eat the chocolate and then just put the caramel into like a massive bowl.
Well, you don't need to anymore. That's the thing.
I just need to buy a tub of condensed milk and simmer it for 3 hours.
Honestly, it tastes exactly the same. I'm sure that's just what it is.
That's crazy. Right. Okay, I'm going to test that. That's blowing my freaking mind.
Yeah. Honestly, I was a bit worried that someone had like pranked me and just said, and it was going to explode in the pan. But
you've got to have a lot of faith in that process. That's 3 hours. That's not. I'll just put it in the microwave for 10 seconds. That's watch it for 3 hours.
Oh, I didn't. I'll be honest. I didn't watch it for 3 hours. I just put it in the pan and sort of let it.
You left it.
I stirred it occasionally.
You live on the edge, Luke. Jeez.
It did look like it was going to
3 hours.
It did look like it was going to explode. And this wouldn't be the first tin good that's exploded on me.
Do tell.
So a download festival. You're probably aware of download festival. It's a music festival, mm-hmm, where lots of people go and enjoy bands and get drunk. And you take like tin food to eat. So the Monday morning when everyone was leaving, we had a big fire just to burn stuff to get rid of. Someone threw a tin of beans on there, it was still sealed, and it it popped, and like it was like a rocket. But like instead of the flames and stuff coming out, it was beating like bean juice and beans, and the tin hit me straight in the neck.
Oh.
It didn't hurt. But it did leave like a red tomato juice around my neck, and people were worried.
That's gotta be the next advert for Heinz.
Yeah.
It's somewhere in slow motion just getting smacked in the neck.
It's an adventurous way of cooking. If I had my mouth open, it would have been some nice presto breakfast.
So you're a lot braver with cooking than I am. My cooking tends to revolve around just food that I can oven and then sprinkle cheese on.
Pizza? Do you mean pizza?
I mean anything. I mean garlic bread. I mean Kievs. I mean fish fingers. Just as long as it's got cheese on, that's cooking.
I honestly think cheese makes everything better.
Yes. Yeah, it does.
Even like cream cheese on dessert, it just makes it good. It's you don't look sure.
I was just thinking, would it work on condensed milk that has been boiled for 3 hours?
Yeah, I think if you did that, put some cream cheese on the top, it would make and maybe some digestive biscuit stuff, it would pretty make a cheesecake, like
Holy
a caramel
crap.
Cheesecake.
Should we just start? Can this be the pilot episode of our cooking podcast?
The Cooking Studio. Welcome to The Cooking Studio, a podcast with independent
publishing company discusses recipes.
Okay, should we get onto the meat of the onto the main course of the evening?
Should we have our palate cleanser first with our big whoops?
Yes, please. That sounds tasty.
I added a H in there as well. Oh, wait, there is a H in whoops. Ignore me. I'm very tired. do you have a big whoop?
Oh, what a big whoop!
Yes, sort of. I have a guilty one. Because it's the No Sleep podcast, and I've not even listened to a full episode, but I only found it today. I mean, I'd seen the logo because I routinely check the charts to see how our podcast, The Other Stories, is doing, and I always see the No Sleep podcast, and I think It's quite a cool little logo there, and I want to check it out. So I did today. It's a fortnightly short story podcast. It's sort of like crowdsourced storytelling because they don't have writers. It's like a subreddit called the No Sleep subreddit or something, and people like put like campfire stories on there. And then this guy, David Cummings, has rolled it and produced it and curated those stories into a very, 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 very popular podcast. And I was just amazed. I was just so impressed by the website, the design, all like the commissioned illustration, the merchandise. And I was like, this is what The Other Stories is going to be. This is what like the next level. It's like, because I feel like The Other Stories is amazing. And we just hit two like quarter of a million downloads. And I was like, what's the next level? And I think this is it.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a look on the website as well. I was incredibly impressed. I definitely think that it's a fantastic way of telling stories, really, isn't it? If you actually get the people involved. I mean, Reddit's obviously massively popular for content, for people having their voice heard. So it's a good way of utilizing that and getting an audience by actually getting the audience to write in for you. And it's quite nice to see communities like that formed.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that 2017 will bring to The Other Stories. Definitely we want to tap into that sense of community and tap into the people that listen and really make it more so that it's not just a wall between the podcast and the people that listen, but we really want to reach out there and sort of start giving stuff back to the people that have been fantastic to us this year.
Yeah, I'm super excited for 2017. I've still got a fair bit of work to do for this year, but I'm just so excited by this year. Has been crazy in terms of how much growth has happened. Like, I think as me as a writer, but also as us as like as publishers and producers of work. And The Other Stories, I think, is our best thing. Like, I was listening I was listening through like some of the old episodes today, and I was like, this is a really good show. Like, even if I didn't make it, I think I'd listen to it.
Yeah. I think it comes back to, I think in one of the earlier episodes of The Story Studio, I think we spoke a little bit about, it was to John, wasn't it, about how your expectations adjust to the things that you've managed.
Yeah.
So over time, we're getting more and more used to the fact that Carl Hughes, the editor of the podcast, is a fucking wizard with sound and just makes everything awesome. And I find he'll send stuff back that will go live for the following Monday and just kind of pass it on and half listen to it. And I'll be listening to it on the way to work going, oh, this is pretty good.
Yeah.
But like you say, if you actually stop and sort of listen to the quality that is coming out of everyone, it's really nice to see.
Yeah. It's exciting. I just want to see, I want to peek into December 2017 and just see what has changed or how it's grown. Because I mean, we're already making like some changes. We're changing podcast hosts. There is going to be sort of adverts. I don't know if that's going to be a good thing or a bad thing, but it does mean there'll be some sort of income, so we can start paying people, which I'm quite excited to do. Not massive amount of money, but
yeah, no, it's as much as it's a lot of what we do is for the audience. It is nice to pay and to actually give something back as well to the people that are helping us. Because I think we say it a lot, but I still don't think we say enough that we're thankful for the narrators, Carl, the editor, Tom, music, everyone that sort of, I guess, donated music in some way that we find to put on the podcast. They're all doing it for free. And obviously we're doing it for free as well. It's all just a massive passion project. But if, you know, a couple of those dominoes fall, then it's going to be a real struggle to produce it.
I'd be interested in getting David Cummings on this show to talk about how they started that in 2011. So what's that, nearly 6 years?
5 years, 6 years.
5 going on 6 years. That's a long time. I'd be interested to see what he's done to grow his podcast as much as he has, because it's definitely one of the up there podcasts in terms of audience size, or it appears to be anyway.
Yeah, for sure. It'll be cool to get him on. Yeah. Send him a message. See what he says.
Yeah. Cool, man. What about you?
My big groups, I think I'm torn between two, so I might just throw both of them out there and just do them quickly. But one of them is I saw Jimmy Carr live last night.
Did you?
Yes.
I saw him live on Netflix the other night.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, I like Jimmy Carr. It's cool. Oh, I will see him live on Saturday, actually, because we're going to go watch the 8 out of 10 Cats Does Countdown filming.
Really?
Yeah, they do it next door to where I work, so we got some tickets.
Nice. Whoever came up with that idea was a genius, because that show works so well. But
I've never seen it.
Have you not?
No.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you need to watch it. It's just the idea of those two things coming together seems like it shouldn't work, but it just so does. But no, I saw Jimmy Carr 2000 and I want to say 8 when I was at college. I saw him in Peterborough, and so he was coming by Lincoln, and I thought, why the hell not? He's fantastic. I enjoyed seeing him live previously, and yeah, blew us away as usual. And it was I was quite lucky because he came to or nearby somewhere I work and managed to get priority tickets. So I managed to get a second row from the front, which was pretty cool. At one point I shouted, he spoke back to me. It was cool.
Oh, this is the moment he normally does in the shows where he says, is there anyone want to heckle? Is that point? Okay, yeah. Well, yeah, did he battle you down?
Well, no, he actually asked the audience what you're supposed to do when a bear attacks you. So I just shouted, be big.
Yeah.
No, there were quite a few drunken people that were shouting out, and he's great just with hecklers in general and stuff. So yeah, that's one of my big groups. And then the other one is I recently got the new Pokemon game.
Pokemon Sun or Pokemon?
Yeah, I got Moon.
Are you going to get Sun as well?
Tempted. We'll see, because I've got a friend who's got the other one, so we can always trade and be cool kids. I make no secret of the fact I'm a big Pokemon fan, and just I've not finished the main storyline yet, but it's definitely a refreshing change to the traditional storyline. There's a lot of sort of big changes that I think are a bit overdue that make this story a lot fresher and a bit more nice.
Is this like more of a reboot? Like, because Kat was telling me to change some of the original 150 to...
Yeah, there are... So the new islands are called Alola, and in this version, there are a select few from the original 150 that have regional variations.
Right.
So they're kind of... It's almost evolutionary that they've adapted to the island and the environment that they're on.
Interesting.
It's pretty cool. There are some that look awesome and some that look just fucking stupid.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying it. It's kind of I had a bit of a binge last week and just played a lot of that. So
I really want to get a console, because I haven't had a console in years. But I'm a little bit worried that I'm going to end up doing that instead of doing productive things like writing and stuff that I should be doing.
Yeah, that's what I did last week.
But yeah, I really want to play Uncharted because you've gone on about it so much. And Last of Us, because you've gone on about it. It's pretty much all the games that you've like recommended. I'm like, I really should play that at some point.
Yeah. Especially the ones that are story-based, I think. I think that's where the only two games I'll ever really go out of my way to play are games for nostalgia or games for story.
Yes.
So things like The Uncharted, they're Naughty Dog's just fantastic at creating gripping stories. Things like the new Crash Bandicoot, which is the reboot of the original trilogy, is coming out next year.
Yeah.
So I'd want to play that. Things like Pokemon Nostalgia I've been playing for years. But it's hardly ever about gameplay for me. It's always about whether or not it's you want to keep on playing.
The only game I've been playing recently... I have three tiers of games I like to play. One, the Nostalgia ones. I play Mega Bomberman, but I play it like it's an old, like a browser emulator.
I
used to have that on my Mega Drive, and I used to play it over and over and over again. So it's nice to just zone out and sort of play that. But I love small, two-hour-long indie story-based games. The ones where you don't have to like give up too much time. It's like you sit down for 2 hours and you sort of just play and get the story out, which is great.
Yeah.
It's a lot of those sort of games. And I love those sort of games like Uncharted. And have you ever played Bioshock Infinite?
I have it, but I haven't finished it.
The ending of that is one of my favourite endings to any game.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's amazing.
Have you played, what was it called? The Something Swan. The White Swan? I can't remember. It's going to bug me. I'll see if I can Google it. Keep talking.
Okay, cool. yeah, so games are cool. I'd love to...
Unfinished Swan. There we go.
The Unfinished Swan? What's that?
Yeah. It's one of those kind of indie games, but it's basically you've almost got a paint gun and you're just on a white canvas. It's all 3D. It's all sort of movable environment, but nothing shows up until you've shot this ball of paint in that direction. It's hit something.
Yeah.
But the further through the game you get, you sort of unveil palaces and that, and you're basically following. It's almost like an abstract kid's story.
Yeah.
Where you're following this one and you have to find it, but it's all sort of representative of dreams and stuff. It's just a beautiful game.
That's cool. Have you played Limbo?
No.
Okay. I'd definitely recommend Limbo. There's another game by that developer I really want to play. But enough about games. So what's happening, Project Dan? It was late July. We were like, let's say it was more like June, where you sent me a document and you were like, here's what we're going to do. We're going to write two novels at the same time. And it's now like 4 months, nearly 6 months later. Wait, is that right?
Five?
Okay, we started writing. We started doing your actual work the last week of July.
24th of July.
Yeah, so it's nearly 5 months, right?
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, is that how maths work?
Oh my god, that's okay, gone cool.
But we're like right now we're like I would say 80% of the way there, maybe even probably further than that actually. So it's gonna be about 6 months for two novels. That's pretty good going, I think.
I think the whole point of originally teaming up was to try and up the production of, you know, novels that have our names on. And I know that one of the things that is massively intimidating to people that are starting to write, or I know at least when I was looking at writing a novel, is, well, there are two elements to it. The first one is the time that it takes to write a novel.
Yeah.
So we listened to Joanna Penn's
the webinar
that she ran on Sunday, which sort of talks about the seven steps to writing a novel. And she kind of goes through the process of how you could write your first draft in a year, which, you know, for some people that's awesome because that's something that they hadn't put times on. Maybe it's a bit more achievable for that year. But at the same time, it's a year long, which isn't a short amount of time. So to write with someone else and to have that sort of speediness to it and have each other check each other's work to speed up the process is one huge benefit we thought originally. And the second one is obviously the loneliness aspect.
Yeah.
So anytime I've written sort of an individual project, you've constantly got to have yourself on your side in order to make sure that you're still going forward, you're still pushing, you're still writing what you want to be doing, and that, you know, you're being disciplined enough to get things out quicker.
Yeah.
But obviously with this project, it just meant that we can hold ourselves accountable to each other and we can give each other sort of
deadlines
that we agree on. But it definitely gives that push. I remember just in that first draft coming up to realizing it was 2 weeks until the deadline and just going, shit, I need to up my pace a bit.
Yeah. So the loneliness thing is like massive, because writing a novel is incredibly lonely and kind of like it's difficult to keep yourself excited, especially for a year. I don't think I could do it in a year because I think it's too slow to get that momentum going.
Mm.
Because the first draft, I do feel like you should need to blast it out as quickly as possible. It feels like doubt is always trying to catch up with you. And you really do have to outrun it in that first draft. Because if you suddenly start doubting yourself, and you're 40,000 words in, it just slows you down. Like, it just creeps up on you, slows you down. And then eventually you just realize, oh, this is really bad. and then you sort of it ends up in that sort of folder of lost novels.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the writing is hard in general, but to have someone that not only understands your process as a writer, but is actually in the process with you and understands for the story you're trying to tell and what you're trying to achieve, and actually someone to bounce ideas back off. Because I mean, my partner, I've been with her for 4 years or so, still hasn't read any of my works at all.
Yeah.
Just nothing. So every time I try and talk to her about a story idea, I'm like, oh, I'm a bit, I'm struggling a bit because I'm thinking, oh, what about this or what about this? And she's just sitting there just going, I can't help you because, but yeah, I mean, should we probably explain a little bit the original process, how it looks, and then maybe even just what the ideas are and where they've kind of sprung from? Because the whole idea, not only sort of to conquer those big hurdles, was also to try and write something that was written to market or as close to market as we can kind of create.
So we started by, like a Google Doc that we both shared. And then we just kept putting ideas down. I think maybe for like a 2 or 3 weeks. I can't remember how long, because we were doing other stuff at the time. And then we were like, just basically putting like tweet length pictures, story pictures to each other. Mm. And I think maybe we had about 10 by the end of the 3 weeks. And we were also at the same time looking at what was doing well on Amazon and like what the stories were, what the cover was like. So we could sort of not steal and copy, but like just get a feel for sort of what kind of thing would work well.
Mm-hmm.
And then what was it? We took a week then to pitch. What was the next step? I can't remember.
So we spoke on, I think it was over the phone, and just kind of batted the ideas around. I think we each kind of took a genre that we're more comfortable writing in, for to sort of take the lead on one story. But then we sort of bounce around the ideas that we had in order to sort of look at any weaknesses, look at anything that kind of spoke to us a bit more. So for example, I think I remember quite clearly that I was torn between two ideas for what has since become Lazarus. And one of them was Lazarus, which is the story of, at this point it was as simple as a boy is at, in Virginia, when a chemical bomb goes off that sets people feral. That was kind of it.
Yeah.
And then the second story, anyone listening, feel free to steal this if you wish, was a deep sea diver kind of gets taken to an undersea, almost like bubble of land and realm, in which he meets his mysterious sort of tribe and people on the surface have to come and find him.
Sounds really cool.
Mm. Yeah, I might get to it one day, but and then yours, you were pretty. I think you got excited about your idea pretty quickly.
Yeah, by that point, I was already like, oh, and then this will happen, and then this will happen. That's changed quite a lot since then. But I think it's called They Remain. I even had like a cover mock-up, which was like a stolen poster from The Thing. So I sort of had a good idea of what I sort of was really excited to write, but then we didn't write. We swapped. Yeah, so at that point we gave each other the basic idea of what we wanted to do, and then we swapped, and then the other person was going to come up with the basic beats of the story and the characters and that stuff. We did that for a week, right?
I think it was about a week, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was just outlining. So I then took all of the sort of ideas that you gave me.
Yeah.
Tried to make them as linear as possible in my head, create a story that we could work with, that we could write, characters that would sort of weave between the storyline and we can throw in there.
Yeah.
And just really start almost just colouring it in a bit, just adding a bit of shade into to the lines. And yeah, that was about a week or so. So I kind of my process, I started a lot with the imagery, started a lot with the locations that would probably be used.
Yeah.
And then took a couple of the key characters that you wanted to have in there straight away and kind of started thinking about them, and then began to weave the storyline out. Like, I think the beach was actually one of the last things I really fleshed out.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's probably my favorite part of the novel writing process. It's because it's at that point where you go, let's go crazy. Let's like, just what if, and like I do a lot of free writing at that point, so I'd just be like, okay, I'm just gonna write 10 ideas of what could happen in the story. This guy could turn into something here. This, and I think from that process, I probably don't want to talk about this story element too much, but it's quite a big story element now. The thing that happens.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, I think the actual beats process, I think maybe I found a couple of like bigger story elements that I thought would definitely need to go in there. Oh, no. Also, I took a map and sort of plotted out the course of where they would go. And then I sort of built a story around there, like beats anyway, like a basic story structure.
Yeah, that was the one thing I think I was missing, was an actual physical map. Because moving forward into future books, I'm definitely going to use a map. But actually, I know the people on the podcast won't be able to see this, but this is what I've been working on for my next work.
Oh, so you did actually print one out.
Yeah, so that's Sparrow, Alaska. One slightly more zoomed in than the other.
It's not as white and snowy as I thought it would be.
No, not in real life, but in my book it will be. I thought it'd be whiter too. But and then kind of came up with all those ideas, wrapped up the package, kind of nodded to each other and went, yeah, and then handed it back over for digestion.
Yeah.
And then any final questions?
Yeah. And then we just have at it. We just started writing.
Mm.
It's if you were going to do it differently this time, next time or whatever, what would you do differently?
Before the first draft, just in the planning process.
Mm, yeah.
So what we ended up finding just in that first draft was that the story that we wanted to tell was far too big.
Yeah, yeah.
For one, our writing style, and two, kind of where we wanted it to go. So I think what I would probably do is look at the beats, and I think now, based on sort of the experience I've got, have a bit more of a realistic...
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Understanding of how each scene might play out.
Yeah.
Just in terms of length and the stuff that we can fit in, because really, that first draft was about a third of the story we'd actually written.
Yeah, so... like the halfway point in the original beats for Lazarus is now the big ending point, and it feels like that. It feels like it was supposed to be that. I think I'd take more time, maybe not take more time with the beating process and the planning out process, but I think I just like to go in a bit more detail and like try and solve more problems. Play devil's advocate a bit more and say, have you thought about this, that this won't work, and try and fix more problems before starting the first draft?
Yeah, I definitely think that in writing the first draft of Lazarus, we're saying spoilers and stuff, aren't we?
Yeah, well, okay, why not? Yeah, yeah.
So we can talk about the dead space a little.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so there's a concept in there called the dead space. I won't go massively into it, but... as I was writing the dead space environment, I realized that I hadn't a clue what it was.
Yeah. In the planning, obviously, we didn't really go into... I don't think we really sussed it out in the planning much.
We just said it existed, but yeah, I think we almost spoke about it as the abstract concept that it was.
Yeah.
But not sort of the physicality of what it would feel like, what, you know, people would be like in the dead space and how everything would look. So
yeah,
that was one of the difficult things. And I found that as I was writing that first draft, I kind of put in the places where it was to appear, but definitely felt that that was a hollow shell that would need some kind of filling in. And
yeah,
that's one thing that I take away from writing that first draft is, if you do feel like you're struggling or get stuck, just write past it best you can and fix it later.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's worse to stop and then like try and figure it out there and then, because then you're going to lose your momentum. Doubt's going to catch up and it's going to get you.
Doubt.
It's going to have its way with you.
It's going to shake its fist in you.
But yeah, I think I'd be a bit less lax with the logic of the plot. And also, I think I'd spend a little bit more time, because I think when I handed you the beats for Lazarus, I don't think I'd quite thought about character progression in terms of the Darkest Night of the Soul moment and when the character would take the lead and become the hero of the story and all that kind of like stuff that really needs to go into story planning. I think I just sort of felt my way through the process a bit more. And I think in your first draft, you had to put some of that stuff in that I'd left out.
Mm.
But yeah, so I'd spend more time doing that, more time getting it right on that aspect.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lot of... because it wasn't until, I think, just before I got your first draft of They Remain and started editing that I actually listened to a few more storytelling podcasts and kind of reading a bit more around what audience expect from commercial fiction. And like you say, the Darkest Night of the Soul, is that the word you use for it?
Yeah, so I mean that if that's the moment I think of is when the shit hits the fan and everything's gone wrong. I'm trying to think of an example in a film or something.
It's the I can't carry it for you, but I can carry you moment.
What's that from?
Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, potentially. Also, Force Awakens. I'm pretty sure there's a bit where Kylo Ren, but they're stuck on the Star Killer base. Kylo Ren's just slashed up Joe, whatever his name is. And Rey is like, you know, down and out pretty much. And then that's the Darkest Night of the Soul moment. It doesn't look like there's any way they're going to come out on top.
Yeah,
I think every story sort of needs to have that.
Yeah. And I think from listening to those, there was definitely, and it's one of the things I am taking forward into the book that I'm currently planning, is using those points as almost the starting points to develop my beats.
Yeah.
So you're beginning how you introduce people, or your hook or your inciting incident. And then kind of just working along the zigzags until you build up to that moment where the shit hits a fan, and then nice conclusion.
Funnily enough, I do kind of feel like you naturally fall into those story beats. When I wrote The Hipster, the first book, I didn't really plan it out. I just sort of, I wrote like 10,000 words and then sort of figured this could happen next, it could happen next. And like, it sort of fell into that process. Mm. Like there is a Darkest Night of the Soul moment, and there is a big sort of climactic boss battle. And I think although we are like taking our time to hit those points and more so in the future, I think you can be like relaxed a little bit and, you know, you will naturally find those rhythms.
Yeah, because I don't think I've ever written or seen anything where it doesn't naturally lead up to a crescendo anyway, because...
Yeah.
Kind of, I think when you're writing a story, or in a lot of cases, I won't say all, but you have that idea straight in your head.
Yeah, yeah.
So when I wrote Sins of Smoke, it was all for me. The whole reason I wrote that was to have that dark kind of final battle moment, that really heart-racing kind of monstrous bit that happens before it all evened out.
Yeah.
Because that's the stuff that I'm kind of hungriest for. That's the big bit of a story. That's what you're reaching towards. And it kind of works out nicely that that's about, you know, towards the end, as opposed to this is awesome, and then just mellow out for 3 hours.
And then just after that bit, there's in one of Chuck Wendig's writing advice books, he said there should be a point in every story where you can't help, as you're reading, but like pump your fist. Like there's got to be like a, oh yeah, fucking right. And it's true. Like when you think of like that moment after The Darkest Night of the Soul, where the hero suddenly takes a stand. They
grow.
Or
you're going to love draft two if they remain.
But like, there has to be that element. And I mean, this, maybe not so much in literary fiction and stuff. You can do anything in that, really. But if you don't have that moment, it's kind of fizzles out into nothing. Like, I think of Firewatch, the game. Have you played Firewatch?
I haven't.
It's one of those 2-hour indie sort of titles. So it all the way through, it leads you to think that there's some great mystery and then something bad's going to happen to you. And there is almost a Darkest Night of the Soul moment, but then nothing happens. It just sort of fizzles out. And the main character, the protagonist, didn't make any significant change to win the game, to win the story. And I feel like that's a good example of, if they were aiming for literary sort of fiction in the sense of or like more of a drama, so not to hit these commercial beats, they succeeded, but it wasn't advertised as that. It was advertised as a mystery thriller sort of thing, which it wasn't in the end. But
yeah,
you will miss those points if you don't hit them.
Yeah, and your audience will feel it as well. I think there's, I mean, even I'll go as far to say, and as always, it will come back to Black Mirror, but in the Shut Up and Dance episode of Black Mirror, for me, that ending, as kind of shocking as it was really unsatisfying.
Yeah, Black Mirror doesn't really, so those sort of stories, they're not really novel-like stories, are they? They're more short stories, so they introduce the concept and then pull the rug. They're more like jokes. So the joke, you introduce the concept, refine the concept and paint the image in the mind, and then you pull the rug in the final bit. That's what the Black Mirror is. It's very much a joke structure. But it's not, there's no growth. There's no personal growth. I think maybe a couple of those episodes are that way, but I only really think of two. The others are more pull the rug stories.
But just coming out of that, I just felt a bit, I loved the episode, as we always say, and I loved the acting. It was all incredible. It was just that end moment. I was like, I didn't have that wholesome roundup. Because it based itself on life. It's the Black Mirror to society. But whereas you're finding as much, just in storytelling in general, as much as you want new, as much as you want something original, you will always know what's going to happen because as you're reading it, the expected will occur. The hero will triumph. The, you know, good will conquer bad. It will all round up wonderfully.
Yeah.
And that's what you want. Otherwise, you are disappointed.
And you know what? People are probably thinking of like Game of Thrones and stuff, and they're saying, well, Ned Stark got his head cut off. But if you think of like the entire arc of Game of Thrones, it's definitely coming around. Like, the dark, I don't know when the Darkest Night of the Soul story bit would be. Maybe that's when, what's her name, blew up that castle for the people. I don't know.
Yeah.
But you know, Jon Snow and Dragon Lady are going to come together, and they're going to be triumphant in the end. So it is going to take that standard story structure. It's just over a much longer, extended period of time.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So we did the first drafts, which took
5 weeks, I imagine, something like that.
About 5-6 weeks.
We did Nano, sort of, not in November, but we did like 50,000 words in under a month, I'm sure of that.
Yeah, 100%. And then once we'd finished the first draft, it was as simple as handing it back over. So I then took They Remain, you took Lazarus. And this comes back a little bit to what we were saying at the beginning, in that once you're finished with a draft of a story, what people generally tend to give as advice for new writers is put it in a drawer for a couple of months, let it, ruminate, do its thing,
And come then back to it with fresh eyes, yeah.
Yeah, as if you're reading it again from the reader's perspective. So essentially what this process allows us to do is to do that,
yeah,
whilst also what having
staying,
that project
staying busy.
yeah. And so, it's still moving forward.
So I'm once we've edited these, and you finish yours, but once we've edited these stories, we'll go back to our original stories with fresh eyes, but they would also have been, like, the ball would have been punted further up the field already. Mm. Yeah. It's interesting. I think this is actually quite a good way to work, and I don't think anyone else does it like this.
No, I think, I mean, a lot of, like, the beats packages and sort of the planning stuff, I think we take a lot from Sterling and Stone.
Yeah.
But actually, you know, running parallel stories as we're going through, I think that's, I know, we'll see how it plays out when they're finally published. I mean, I personally have never felt more confident in a story as I currently do with They Remain. And whether that's, I don't know, sort of just wishful thinking as it is at the minute, but I'm happy with what we've got so far. So for me, the process is working 5 months on, and we're kind of, I think by the looks of it, these books will be will potentially be published around February, March time.
Yeah. And then that'll give us a bit of time to start on the second books. I think I was going to ask, I'd be interested to try it the other way, in the sense of one of us write the first draft and the second person maybe has like a 2 week delay before they start editing the first draft. Or do you think that's
not... just kind of like playing catch up?
Yeah, maybe it'd be quicker, but I mean, I don't know how that would work, because sometimes when you write a draft, you like to go over, loop back around and fix bits. So maybe not. I don't know.
It could be worth looking at. It's always worth trying stuff. Because that could be a good way to do it. But like you say, you've always got potentially bits where, well, for example, if you were going first and you got to a bit where you were having a bit of trouble and you got stuck, I'd kind of have to play catch up to get to where you were at before you kind of went off again, I think.
Yeah, it might complicate the flow a little bit.
Mm.
But yeah, so we did the first drafts. We got into a point where we were like, I can't look at this book anymore.
I'm so sick of this. I want to write anything else but this. I want to write obituaries.
Yeah, so it was a perfect time to swap. And then we did a quick read through. So we read through each of his first drafts, made some notes. We're like, this could change. This is cool. And then we got on the blower. And
that's what we British people call a phone.
Yes, quite. And then we were like, this is good. I'm going to change this. What do you think to this? And then we just sort of had discussions about the stories.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say just circling back a little bit to the reading part, one of my tips for anyone looking to reread their work, I find it so helpful to export it and to read it on Kindles or on e-readers, which is significantly different to... I personally feel that if I read my own work on an e-reader, I prefer it, because I'm used to reading on an e-reader, and so my head is in a certain way that it expects...
It's not in writing mode. Writing mode. You're in reading mode.
Whereas if you are reading it on your landscape screen, it's very, very different. And your head's kind of, more in writing and editing mode than it is appreciation mode.
You know, in illustration and drawing, one of the things that they get you to do, they get you to draw a picture, but they turn the picture upside down. So let's say it's a person. If you're drawing a face, you draw what you think a face should look like rather than drawing what you see. So to force yourself to actually work from what you are looking at and not from what not separating it with that other image in your mind of what it is. You flip the picture around upside down, and then you lose all reference of what should be there, and you're just looking solely at the thing for what it is.
Yeah, I could see that working.
Yeah, so I think if anything, I'd like to print off the book and read it on paper with a red pen, but I don't really do that. I normally export it to iBooks and read it on the tube or the bus,
the wheel tube,
the upstairs tube. And that just like getting in a different, I know some people that change the font on the screen, they like to change the font size or anything like that. It seems to just work.
Yeah. It's definitely, I had a point and now it's gone. Oh no, that's it. When it actually comes around to the book being in a state where it feels like it's ready to go and it's sort of all lined up on CreateSpace for a proof, there's definitely something I want to do is actually just read through it as a book.
Yeah.
To see if it feels how I think it feels.
Yeah, like papery.
Yeah, papery and smelling a bit like wood.
Feel like a book, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I'll order it. Approve.
Yeah. I think, I mean, personally, I'm massively anal when it comes to formatting any type. So no matter if anyone ever sends me anything to read or whatever, I will automatically format it to a particular way first before I can read it, because that's just how my head is wired.
That's good. Yes. I'm not like that, so it's good to have you there to do that kind of stuff.
I just like things to be pretty. Yeah. But yeah, and then so we had our chat on the blower. And again, one of the things about writing with someone else is having a level of trust and a level of understanding. So I think a lot of people, the idea of working with someone is an attractive idea, but it's difficult to find people that you ordinarily would click with or would kind of understand how you work as a writer. Because I know that for a lot of people writing, and it's fully understandable, writing is, it's precious, it's personal. A lot of people have their idea of things they want to write.
Yeah.
And having someone else's fingers in your jam might spoil the taste a bit.
Yeah.
But I think we mentioned previously as well, I never originally looked to co-write with anyone, but the kind of opportunity presented itself.
Yeah, me too. I think most writers, when you start out, you don't think, I want to be a co-author. Like, it's not something you always think, I want to be the author. And like, it's like when you start making films, everyone wants to be the director, because you want to have your vision perfectly out there. But then I think as I've gotten older and had written more stuff, I think, and made more stuff, I think I've kind of lost that ego a lot. Like, I know there will be times, there will be stories when I can do exactly what I want to do and use the turn of phrases that I want to do, but it doesn't have to be now. And I'm enjoying this process probably a little bit more than I would writing on my own. Cause it's got new challenges, it's different. It's interesting. And it's more like playing in a band than up there on the stage on your own, like singing in front of everyone.
Yeah.
Although you don't mind that. I've seen pictures. You don't mind that at all.
But it's also, I mean, there are sort of countless benefits. I'm sure there are also a few flaws, although to be honest, I can't really see too many flaws. I think the only real sacrifice is, and it's not really a sacrifice, is that it, you know, the book does share your name, whereas again, a lot of people would want just their name on something. And the other downside, I suppose, is explaining to other people what we're doing and how it all works. But the benefits, it kind of goes, you know, miles and miles. As you're going along, you've got someone that's almost like is your critic in both the good and the bad way. So you kind of pick up on the bits that aren't quite working and you can develop them and work together for that. At the same time, like, there are massive sections that you've written in They Remain where I'm just like, this is awesome, I fucking love this. And vice versa, so it gives you that little bit of an ego boost as well as you're going through. And one of the things that we said from the off, and I think helps, is that we were very clear with what we kind of saw this process being, in just it being open. As long as it serves the book, there isn't an ego in it, we'll just do whatever it takes to make the book the best it can be between us.
Yeah, I think that's, we sort of made that like verbal contract, didn't we? That like, it's not really about us, it's about making the book as good as it can be. And like, that sort of takes any ego out of the process anyway. I always feel like when I'm reading through the book, I'm always thinking, how can I make this better? I'm not ever thinking, how can I make it more me?
Yeah. Like,
and I think if that ever sort of does come into my mind, it leaves pretty quickly. I'm not bothered about it being my work of art, my magnum opus. There'll be time for that. I'll do that when I'm like 60 or something.
Yeah, especially because we are writing what we're aiming to be quite commercial, something that we're proud of, something that, you know,
yeah,
wars decide and everything that will make some money. Yeah. And I, yeah, on several occasions, I think initially in the first handover, that was a bit of a scary thing. Just because, especially in giving the feedback to the other person, you're almost inclined on saying all the nice stuff and not saying the things that you didn't actually think quite worked. But again, at the start of that conversation, we just said, look, open up, say what you think, and we'll go from there.
That's something you get better at as you go along as well. I think it helps the fact that we know each other's writing styles quite well, and so because we've done a lot of the other stories together, so not written them together, but I've read a lot of your short stories and you've read a lot of mine. We sort of understand what each other's writing styles are like, and I think I would tell people to at least co-author one book, because I've learned just as much in this process than I did when I wrote my first novel. Like, there's that. You see things in your own style that are like really weak. When you see like someone else doing something better, and you're like, "Oh, that's why am I not doing it like that?" So it's good. It's a good learning process.
Yeah, it rounds you up a bit more. It just makes you a bit more, like you say, aware of what you're writing and how it's written.
Yeah, it makes you aware of what you're doing, good or bad. It just makes you more aware of it.
Yeah.
So where are we now? Like, you finished your second draft.
Mm-hmm. So I finished the second draft of They Remain a couple of days ago. You're coming up to your finish now?
It will be probably this week. I'm pretty sure Friday, yeah. And then we're going to swap. Another read through. And at this point, there shouldn't be any like major changes, right? So at this point, we're hoping that maybe like some changes here and there, but nothing. We won't go, oh my God, that entire arc needs to change.
We hope.
Yeah, we hope. I'm pretty sure we've ironed through that just through the discussions we've had.
Yeah. That's the hope, that everything will be smoothly. And I think ideally, in a perfect world, we'd have one more look through the books each, then maybe send it off to some beta readers and a proofreader, and then get it ready to publish.
Yeah, and then launching the books is an interesting one. I don't know. I mean, there's so many ways you can do it. There's so many options. Should you go exclusive with Kindle? Should you go wide? Do you launch the book free for the first few days? There's so many things to choose from here. And the fact that we've got two books means we can play a little bit more.
Yeah. Yeah, we can sort of experiment and see what works the best, I guess.
Yeah, maybe the next time we do this sort of show, this episode, we'll do the launch, like what we did and why and how it went.
Yeah, that'll work.
Also, I just saw Tim Grahl, you know, from your favourite podcast, The Story Grid.
Yeah.
He just launched a new podcast called Book Launch, and it's all about like how to launch a new book.
Oh, awesome. So he must have finished it then.
Well, he was launching books as a marketer before he wrote books.
Okay.
So I think he did like traditional publishing launches and also like a lot of indies as well, like Hugh Howie, I think he worked with. But he knew how to do that, and then he's now learning how to write a book.
Oh, fair enough.
Yeah.
That'd be interesting to have a listen to and see if they've got any hints and tips.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a little bit nervous because, you spent so long doing an idea, you want it to sort of get out there a little bit.
Yeah, I think my underlying attitude to it all, I think in a kind of vain, egotistical way, is one of the things that will help us keep going, is that at the end of the day, if it doesn't make any money, we're no worse off than we are now.
Yeah.
And, you know, the process itself has been enjoyable. It's been educational. It's been fun.
Would be nice to make some money, though.
It would be awesome to make some money, yeah. But, we'll see. And, you know, we've got plans. 2017 will be, I think, a very, very productive year if we kind of plan it and play our cards right. But,
yeah.
Yeah. We'll do, we're doing a roundup show, aren't we?
For the next week, I bet. Yeah, we're doing like what we learned in 2017. on my old podcast, I did it for 2015. Yeah, it must be 2015, and it went down pretty well. It's like the most downloaded episode. So we'll try and recreate some of that magic.
Beautiful. Did we want to do five questions at each other, or?
Let's do three questions each.
Okay.
Quick fire round. Daniel, what's your favorite type of cheese?
Cheddar. Mozzarella.
I don't know. I would say Gorgonzola, just because I like the name.
Okay. Penguins or wall rye?
Wall rye?
What's the plural of walrus?
Oh, okay. I don't know.
What did you think it was?
I thought it was like some sort of wall decorating material. Some like rye, some sort of fabric put on there. Penguins. Can't beat penguins.
Walrus.
Did you know that the plural of octopus is not octopi, even though people say that all the time?
I thought it was.
And even if you Google it, it will say octopi. It should be octopode. That was the original pluralization.
I prefer that.
Octopode. And I still say it. People say, no, you're wrong. But I read it in a book years ago.
I'm also trying to get the plural of house as heist to catch on because heist. It literally makes no sense.
Houses. Yeah. Heist. Look at all those heists. You sound a little bit Irish, I think, when you do that.
Look at all those heists.
Scottish or Irish? I don't even know what that means.
Scottish.
I think I go very Irish myself. Mainly because of Conor McGregor. It can't be a bit of Conor McGregor.
Yeah. Who's your spirit writer?
I think we've already done this one.
Have we done this one?
Yeah.
Who's your spirit animal?
It's difficult. Half dog, half cat. Cat dog. What about you?
Platypus.
Really?
Platypode.
Platypi. Another question, I guess. Do you use credit cards or are you against credit?
I have a credit card and I'm against credit cards.
What is the long card number on your credit card?
4751-2639-8492-8130.
That sounds like it could be right.
Yeah, it's not.
4751, I'm sure that's the start of most credit cards, right?
Yeah, okay. Potentially. Digital or analog time?
I can't tell analog time. No. I can, but it takes me a while. I just never did it as a kid, so I always have to look at it. And... You know how I
did not do time as a kid?
No, I just had a digital watch for my first watch. Kids. Yeah, and it's probably not done me well because it takes me a couple of seconds to look up and okay, it's that time. But it's like Kat doesn't know her left and right. She has to do that.
I can't ever understand that whole... I'm trying to teach
Just so
Bailey
people know, you hold your finger and your thumb up, and then the one that spells the L is your left hand. But it's just those things, if you don't learn them as a kid, you just sort of go on through life, and some people can't swim. And I think that's how can you not... you just sort of get in the water and move.
Wave your arms, yeah. I mean, it does most of it for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One last question then we'll finish up the show. Where do we send people to this week?
HawkandCleaver.com, where we are currently giving away 5 free signed copies of the brand new The Other Stories print edition. And you can also vote on the next theme for The Other Stories between monsters and space.
Yeah, help us get our podcast bigger because The Other Stories deserves a bigger audience. It's got a pretty big audience, but I'm greedy now and I want more. Yeah. Forever more, come on. It needs more people.
Enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Bye.
Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Story Studio podcast. Still hungering for some podcast goodness? Then why not check out our other show, The Other Stories? Oh, and did you know, every time you leave us a review in the iTunes store, a puppy is born. Cute, eh? Anyway, toodle pip.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.